When players are explaining the rules to each other on live television, it's That's So MLS, a North American soccer podcast with myself, Andrew Bates, and Nick Thornton.
Hello.
Nick, how are you doing after this soccer Sunday?
Oh, man, I feel as tired as Seattle and Portland's legs after 120 minutes of play and then a shootout. I'm tired, man. It was good to watch so many full games, but there's something about the drama of playoff soccer that's got me feeling a little wrung out today.
Well, it's kind of funny because, like, I largely, like, blew off. Well, I didn't blow off on purpose the knockout rounds, but I definitely, like, the first legs didn't matter so much to me, but almost all the second legs were great. Yesterday, I did start with the Copa Libertadores final and then sort of bleed in through there to Sporting Kansas City. I missed the first 20 minutes of that one, which was kind of a shame because it seemed like that's where all the important stuff happened. And then rolled all the way through. But despite the fact that I watched four games in one day, for some reason I felt less soccer exhausted than I did after one Portland-Seattle game.
True. And I think it's because I think that was the best match out of the four. It was the most competitive. It was the most compelling, not just because of the hilarity of watching, as you said before, players explaining each other the rules right before they went to penalty kicks. Of course, Portland, a number of Portland players, about half of them were celebrating because they thought they won on away goals, but realized they hadn't and it was going to penalty kicks. But it felt like there was more in this game. And it's interesting to me too, because I just went back to watch the highlights, and the highlights don't start until the 67th minute.
Well, this is the thing, right? After the first 45, Portland have got that 1-0 win from that they had at home, right? So you look at the first 45 and you think, oh, Portland's probably winning this. They've got this formula that will take them through, that will theoretically take them through. It seems like they have Seattle beat, and they did win, but so much happened.
So much soccer happened
between 0-0 at halftime and the eventual conclusion of the tie. The first one is the Raul Ruiz Diaz goal at 68 minutes. Which really, like, switched the momentum 100%. And at that point, you almost say, like, oh, I don't think it's going to happen for him. After being very, 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 you know, serious about it just before. And then Blanco, I don't have notes, so I'm just trying to remember it in my head.
Well, the first half was pretty chippy. I mean, it was an awful lot of... there was quite a number of fouls in the first half and with little else.
Yes.
And kind of began to look like, well, how do you really call it? Like, what's going to happen here? And, you know, and some mischances and things not quite connecting. But that's sort of, I guess, in a way, what you'd expect between two teams that have played each other a lot and do know a lot about each other with both everything on the line, is that there kind of just needed to be 65 minutes or so of feeling each other out and trying to get a hold on the game. But I agree that Rio Diaz's goal is just like... Well, I mean, that feels like that changes the momentum, but it doesn't.
I feel like because there had been that, you know, the momentum had seemed very secure. By the time that Blanco scores, it's like when Blanco's before then, you have a very specific Portland, a Portland that is playing shutdown, like a shutdown game, a Portland that is trying to manage its stuff. And then when very soon after the Ruiz Diaz goal, Blanco gets it. It's like, ah, this is what we're doing.
Right.
And I'm still trying to like look up the circumstances of that one. But so then with that goal, they go back into, you know, a pole position where because of the away goal situation, it's tied No. Yeah, at that point it's 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, I'm trying to remember it, and I'm still.
Let's put it this way: they traded goals back and forth a little bit, right. And it was, and then of course because it needed to go into added time, Portland thought they had won it, and then it went into the extra time. Seattle wins a free kick, wins a penalty, and Lodeiro converts, and then that ties everything up. However, I don't totally blame the Portland players for celebrating winning, because at that point, you just think like, well, we've scored enough goals, they're each worth two or something, therefore we're going ahead. But at that point, it was just tied, and then that's what took us to the penalties.
Well, I thought it was
the Lodeiro penalty kick.
There had been a lot of noise made because of some injury substitution, like some injury people going to the sidelines, etc., of how much stoppage time there was. And Rui Diaz scored in stoppage time to even it up. But Asprilla scored, much was made of the fact that his scoring record in the regular season for Portland has not been very good at all. And he has scored almost as many goals in the playoffs as he has in the regular season in like well under half the amount of games.
Yeah. And that's what your players need to do in the playoffs, right? Like, anyway, well, let's keep talking about the flow of the game. So it goes to penalties, and things kind of look like, well, you know, we know Seattle can win on penalties.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's it is again Asprilla that ends up getting the final goal.
Yes.
And, you know, Frey sort of gets a hand to it. I wasn't sure about this one because Antonella has looked a little shaky at times, especially on penalties. Did not look good on the Lodeiro penalty kick. And so I was a little bit surprised that Portland came out in front, but overall, if I'm looking at the whole game, I feel like Portland did look stronger. And I think, especially on the night, we're definitely the better team. Seattle had their chances, and Seattle came up with a little bit of Seattle magic, but mm-hmm. I think that's the thing that we've seen well, we did see it last year, and we certainly saw it the year before, is that they somehow just pull things together, even though the connective tissue of the team isn't always there. And so it was a good performance, but I think Portland did deserve this one.
Absolutely. It's all coming back to me now, A, that I'm looking at my tweets, but also B, that you mentioned at Nella, because he looked like he had walked 1,000 miles. And
dude looked tired.
I don't want to just like repeat all the things that happened in the game, but I feel like going blow by blow through, like, I feel like to a certain extent, what was so interesting about the game was how often things changed, because, you know, this in Atenella is a through line through all of this, because that first goal, I was trying to remember how did it happen? Atenella comes up to grab across and he reaches it in time, but he just drops it, I guess. Like he's successfully able to stop the ball with his hands outstretched, but he just doesn't have the like grip.
Yeah.
And then it falls down, it bounces, and Rui Diaz comes to collect. And at the end, you had mentioned, Atenella has this look about him where he looks shaky.
I think a theme over the four playoff games this week was that when there's a penalty, the goalkeepers tend to move quite early.
Mm-hmm.
And as Antonella's diving to the right, I believe it is, like, Lodeiro's just stepped to the ball. And so I felt like that was a really big mistake. It's like, especially with somebody like Lodeiro, you need to wait until the last possible minute. Because, you know, he's not necessarily a guy that's going to blast it into the corner. He's going to carefully wait his chance. He might send it down the middle or chip it over you, but he just makes it so easy for him because the goalkeeper converts or commits so early into that. And that's where I was thinking, like, if this goes to penalties, that's got to be weighing heavy on Atenella's mind, that he just goes way too soon on that penalty kick.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like I would split the game into three periods, like into three, like sort of, I guess, sets. This early sort of exchange of goals that gets it to 2-1. Your weird injury time to extra time one period where we're going, you know, we've reached 90 minutes. Portland is going through. Rui Diaz scores in injury time, and now Seattle is now they've created an extra time situation. Asprilla scores right at the beginning of injury time, and I am the smart Alec that says, if only they had, you know, everybody's complaining about 6 minutes of added time. It's like, if only they had given Noel about four more minutes of added time, we wouldn't even be in this situation. And then Portland is going through on that result, and then there he is still that final Lodeiro goal. So, like, that's the second act. And by this point, you know, I have seen, like, soccer Twitter was going crazy, especially me, because I was like, it was like past 2 a.m. at that point for me.
Yes.
But people are saying, you know, MLS chaos is the only winner.
Well, and to give some context, too, is the last time we recorded an episode was that night. Yeah. And so we sort of signed off that episode being like, all right, well, you know, we'll catch the rest of this game. And knowing that it was, you know, probably about 12:30 your time there on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. At the point where you tuned into the game. And so
I skipped the whole first half.
Where I was just like, oh, Andrew's not going to sleep tonight.
I'm just not sleeping. No. Well, I slept a little bit, but it's like, you know, the commentators are saying, we're beyond the map at this point. And that's how it felt. Like you know, Jason Davis on Twitter is like, I'm not doing drugs, but this game makes me feel like I'm on drugs. I don't know if it's easy to explain to people, you know, after the fact, but that everything was changing so wildly, and that first the extra time two proved how crazy extra time one was, because usually in an extra time people kind of let off a little bit, but like whatever crazy you know, fever pitch the end of the game had reached, they just kept, both teams kept their feet on the throttle heading into that time.
Which is what happens when there's tired legs like this, right? Like, play does open up a bit. But that was the compelling thing about this game, is that every time, you know, goals were literally just exchanged throughout the match. But every time somebody scored, you sort of felt like, okay, hang on a minute, this changes everything. And then Seattle would score, and you're like, well, no, hang on a minute, this changes everything. And then Portland would score again. You're like, well, now I just don't know. We could be here a while.
So, like, you know, at the end of extra time, I guess, depending on how you're boxing it, if it's the third or the fourth, or you know, if the shootout is the third or the fifth act, what is crazy about it to me is this idea that you start off with the Antonella that's looking shaky. And you think, well, they've got to get something. They've got to get something for this to work out. And Bruin hits the post, and I'm thinking, oh, well, this is how it's going to be. This is how, you know, Portland is going to win. This is how Portland is going to win without having to worry about that. Is, you know, they'll hit the post, and Antonella doesn't have to make a save. And then he makes a save on the very next Seattle shot.
Yeah.
And then Portland looked like they're going to win, and then Ridgewell himself is saved. But eventually it is Asprilla at the end who becomes the, as people are calling him now, Mr. November.
A little rude, but sure. Yeah, we'll take it. Exciting match all the way around. I mean, it's kind of hard to pick a team to choose, a team to cheer for here on the... in Cascadia, but I think I did confirm with a few folks on Twitter that if you're a Whitecaps fan, it's safe to say that we hate the Timbers less than we hate the Sounders. So we're somewhat vindicated in that.
I was having a conversation with an American today at work about how whenever you have these three, you know, a long-standing rivalry between two American cities, and there's also a Canadian city in there, they're always like, you guys are fun. So that was a lot. I got a minimal amount of sleep, but it was fine. and was just like, just all the next day, all I could think of was, wow, that was such a good game. That was so crazy. I'm so glad I watched that.
Who won?
Who won? Ish? Question mark? I mean, like, I felt so bad for Seattle fans. You know, I don't, you know, the Seattle friends that I have on Twitter. You know, it must have been so hard. But you know, to the people that went on that away game, that must have been a crazy, crazy experience.
Absolutely.
Because of this, I guess there was a scheduling issue, is what I remember hearing last week, that caused it to be on Thursday. But so there was a moment for everyone to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Sporting Kansas City versus Real Salt Lake on Sunday night. A lot popped off here very early. What did you make of the early brace of goals from Sporting Kansas City?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the first 20 minutes, even outside of the two goals for Sporting Kansas City, they looked to be on top, and they really did just look like, okay, Real Salt Lake got themselves into this position and earned themselves a bit of luck, but they're way out of their depth here. They're just not equal to the task. And for 20 minutes, it really, really did look that way. And then, and really for much of the first 45, I was amazed that things went into the second half at 2-0. I thought RSL was pretty fortunate in that regard. But then, speaking of a tale of two halves,
yes,
everything just kind of shifts. And this, I feel like Sporting Kansas City in the first 45 minutes was like the Sporting Kansas City we've seen all season. They just looked completely masterful. They were pressing so high. RSL had no idea what to do. They were getting pulled out of position. I mean, Rubio and Shalloway score with relative ease, and it just seems like RSL defensively is completely torn apart and has no way to cope. And even at the beginning of the second half, it still looks like more or less the same. Like, Petke hasn't actually told his players anything, and the game starts up the same way. But then it feels like Sporting Kansas just completely takes the foot off the gas and forgets what they're doing, loses their shape. Sauceda comes in, scores a goal. You know, 7 minutes later, SKC gets another one back. So it's 3-1, and you're still thinking, well, okay, it's got to be Sporting Kansas that wins this one. And then somehow Krylak finds a way to answer that, and so it's 3-2. And you're just thinking, like, what is happening here? This should have been, for me, and no disrespect to Real Salt Lake, but especially considering the way the game was going up till the 67th minute, you're just like, Sporting Kansas has this one. Like, okay, RSL gets a goal, but they've got to put this one to bed. This should be easy. They're playing better across the board. Krylak gets the second goal, and all of a sudden you're thinking, like, RSL could do this. Like, they're looking like they could score another and possibly two. And Sporting Kansas City has just completely lost their shape. What's your read on the game?
The number one thing that I kind of saw at this point where so much had come from late on from I want to say Riznak wasn't on the score sheet, but Damir Krylak. So it wasn't like... It was interesting to me, you know, when he finally did get that goal. I'm seeing on the Twitter feed that somebody used the Jon Snow clip from Game of Thrones at that time. But the weird thing about the swings in this game that sort of stayed with me is that I kind of feel like Real Salt Lake did have plenty of chances late on to equalize. Not, mm-hmm. you know, not that, you know, in terms of the early ones, you know, other than starting the game on the 0th minute instead of the 20th minute, other than that, there was like, you know, mm-hmm. there wasn't a lot you could look at and be like, oh, well, we kind of messed this one up. But it's like, there were so many opportunities for them to take that despite the fact that it was a fight back situation, and you, in a fight back situation, you'll sometimes think, oh, well, you know, at least they did so well to get to 3-2. They had so much of the They had so much in the final stages that it was kind of a surprise to me that they weren't able to get anything out of it. And when Daniel Chalobah finally scores late on to, you know, a 90 plus 7, it really feels like a little disappointing because of how many, you know, goal plated chances that they had in key positions. And I think the one that a lot of people are talking about, I want to make sure that I'm talking with the right person. There was a really big, or was it Diego Rubio for Sporting Kansas City that had a crazy miss? There was like there was one miss that was like crazy from point blank range.
Oh, I forget that one.
It might have been.
Yeah. I think it was Rubio who was took a heavy touch and almost had another one
in front of an empty net. Okay, well then that was the other way around. You know, because that was a Sporting Kansas City chance. But I do feel like there were some pretty key chances in some times where they had the ball in the box with a reasonable chance to shoot, but they took a second too long to take it. And I don't know. I don't know what that says about the final performance, but I just left this thinking by the time that Chalobah scores the final goal, I end up thinking that they could have maybe done a little better with it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that I would say late in the second half, it feels like Sporting Kansas kind of hands it to RSL. But deep into stoppage time, I feel like RSL just hands it right back to Sporting Kansas. I mean, that final goal for them is just such a brutal breakdown in communication and error at the back from Raimondo and his defender that it's just kind of unacceptable at that point. And it feels for me like, you know, to have come so far and to get so close, it was weird that at 3-2 it seemed like, oh, the balance of power switching, look at RSL getting back into it. And at 4-2 it was just like, oh no, there it is, that makes sense. They were kind of coasting on fumes a little bit there. I mean, the big thing too, I think, that makes this one a little bit hard to judge in terms of what do we take away about Real Salt Lake at this point is that Albert Rusnak was out, suspended for a second yellow that he picked up. And also the rookie of the year, Corey Baird, was out due to concussion protocol. And so you really have to wonder that with two such crucial pieces, what might have happened. Now, of course, that's not how MLS or any sports league works. It's not about the players who aren't there. It's about the players who are, and you're supposed to have depth.
Although, but let me get out the drum that says accumulation in the playoffs to that tight degree is ludicrous.
It seems a little bit odd. However, I mean, yeah, you wonder with one of those or two of those what might have happened. But it was just, it was so weird to watch Sporting Kansas City just completely, utterly break down against a team that has caused them many, many problems in the past. But on paper and in terms of results, you just feel like, how is Sporting Kansas City making this so difficult for themselves? And, you know, we were talking yesterday a little bit about like, okay, there's four teams left. I have no idea which two teams make it to the final. But thinking a little bit more about it, if Sporting Kansas City can't get their mentality together, I'm not sure that they make it past Portland. And if they do, I don't see them beating any of the possible three Eastern components that they're up against. And just because it was a complete like mentality breakdown that happened against an opponent that they should have dealt with rather tidily. And it seemed like at first they were.
I think that the big thing, you know, that you can look at as you envision a Portland and a Sporting Kansas City matchup is that Blanco goal that was the first Portland goal in the Seattle game. Because where, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, Sporting Kansas City, how they press so much, but it's like where Portland have that edge and have that sort of weapon is their ability to break back and turn the tables with players of high quality.
Yeah.
Interesting, given the timing that I don't think they're... There is a way to think about how they could beat Portland, and I think it really comes down to, you know, how the defenses react. I think that Sporting Kansas City has a slightly better defense than Portland does.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
Tim Melia hasn't been on a walk to the desert, or through the ancient Greek marathon. Or the long dark night of the soul that we describe at Nella having been on. So that is a kind of an edge because that front three from Sporting Kansas City is in a different way as dangerous. But I just feel like Portland has the ability to exploit some vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
It's interesting to try and sort of, you know, diagnose Real Salt Lake season because they could have not made it into the playoffs just as easily as they made it into the second round. They could have lost in the second round as easily as they made it here, you know, like, or the first round as easily as they made it here. And so it's tough to say that they overperformed or underperformed. I think that this is, looking at the beginning of the season, this is a pretty good response from this group.
Yeah, and if we're thinking about evaluating their season, I mean, the fact that we're disappointed by them crashing out of the playoffs at this point against Sporting Kansas City, I think tells us a lot about the point that they've been able to get to and the type of chances they've been able to create for themselves. It still feels like there's some key pieces missing and perhaps some players there that have overstayed their welcome and need to be replaced with a little bit higher caliber players. But there's an awful lot of the raw ingredients there that you have to think, as much as the team has struggled, they've put themselves in this position for a reason. And if we're going to criticize their performance against one of the best defenses in MLS, then for not scoring more than two goals against them, I think it says a lot, I think.
I think that one of the things that I'd be interested in is that there are, for RSL, is that there have been a couple of sort of young, interesting players who have been bouncing around the league this season. Dominic Baggi is one, Kellen Acosta is another, Justin Merrim is another. And we may still see some of those players or some players like them dislodged again in the offseason. I think maybe securing the services of one of them could be a crucial piece for RSL.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking about, I think it must have come up during the Red Bulls game, but somebody mentioned Sasha Kljestan, and I just thought, man, what an interesting link he could be, considering he's had no luck at Orlando. Imagine him running the midfield and pulling the strings for Real Salt Lake. So it would be a different look for them, but... And I'm not saying it's likely. I just do it. And it was a thought that popped into my head.
I don't think the man. We talked after the show last week about questions, so we can talk about player options in a minute.
Yeah.
So we have our Western Conference final set: Portland versus Sporting Kansas City. The next task on the weekend was to head to Atlanta to get our first two Eastern Conference finalists.
Mm-hmm.
With Atlanta, New York City, a game I was very ready for. I had it on. I was watching the pre-game. I saw their awesome saxophone anthem player with no sung lyrics, but with the saxophone playing the U.S. national anthem and an anthem signer. And then I fell asleep.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I missed that part, and then shortly after you fell asleep, New York City fell asleep. So, I'm assuming you've seen the highlights of this one.
Yes.
If we can call it that.
Martinez gets this early penalty kick on what I want to say is the slowest moving penalty. Not that it's not
yeah.
true.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true.
Letter of the law, yes.
The foot was in the wrong place. The player fell over the foot. There was probably not a chance for the player to stop their motion. The attacking player to stop their motion or the defensive player to retract their foot. But wow, it looked like it was, you know, with a lot of talk in the pregame about this idea of referees being very watchful of Atlanta. It was the slowest penalty.
I felt like they were sort of gifted that one. I mean, I know letter of the law, but like he's not even in a position to score. I know it's a foul in the box, whatever, but sure. We can call that a penalty. There's lots of things we haven't called penalties this year, but we're at Mercedes-Benz, so it's a penalty. And of course, Martinez sinks it. Fair, fine, to be expected. But New York City just looked like, I don't know if they knew quite what to do with a full pitch, but they just looked ragged. Almiron's free kick is something else. I mean, there's really nothing any goalkeeper, any team can do about that one.
This one was especially like a perpetual motion machine.
Yeah, you need to go watch that free kick. It is truly something else. And
a lot of people.
Go ahead.
A lot of people were kind of looking at it almost as like an Almiron elegy. You know, there's still one more home. He's still got one more home game before anybody, you know, poaches him. But there was the air. There was something of the air of a goodbye for Almiron, and also for Tata Martino, who got a big statue-esque tifo at the beginning. And there was something wistful about how they treated that.
Yeah, and I mean it felt like a team with everything to prove. They also broke the postseason attendance record again. With, I think it was like 70,530 people there.
Stupid, sexy Atlanta.
Like, that's... We're not necessarily fans of breaking down every single attendance in MLS here, but that... Come on.
It's impressive. It's impressive every time. And I mean, like, that's what... It's like, it's interesting because it conveys, like... It conveys a competitive advantage, but at the same time... It is a competitively won advantage, you know? Like, it's not the same as, getting a very good, you know, attacking midfielder. But you could argue that the reason, you know, if having 50 to 70,000 people at every game is conveying them bonuses in terms of, you know, making them harder to beat at home... whether or not that's on the, you know, on the when it comes to the whistle or not, they win that by doing a thing that a soccer team is supposed to do, which is be entertaining and have people come to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I guess like it's 50-50, but they've certainly delivered on a huge American, you know, the dream of an American big time sports event.
Absolutely. But, I mean, turning back to the game, sure, Chanot gets one right before the second half, but the second half starts much the same way again, and I felt like Atlanta really just started playing their game, and at no real point outside of kind of that lucky goal just before the half did New York City feel like they had any way into this game, really. A couple of brief spells of possession, but that was really it. Yeah. I mean, this was just all Atlanta the whole time. And it was overall kind of a disappointing match because I thought New York City did have something to prove. I sort of felt like they would have had the bit between their teeth to come and play spoilers. And it just seemed like there was a communication breakdown defensively. They didn't seem to have a great game plan in terms of dealing with Atlanta. And really at no point did it feel like they had a lifeline into this game.
No, that doesn't sound like it. I'm looking at the... Oh yeah, was it even an own goal? Yeah, I'm looking at that New York City goal, and it was again like a set piece that didn't necessarily have anything to do with anything. You're right to say that they're, you know, they didn't really show a lot, and if you're going to diagnose New York City, I have to say that as I have been impressed on multiple occasions, I was impressed again by Valentin Castellanos, who seemed to sort of kickstart a lot of his own opportunities when he was brought in. But it did seem again like the attack was not firing together on all cylinders.
No, and you know, they made this New York Red Bulls, New York City FC comparison about in terms of like both having new managers halfway through the season, or at least midway through the season. New York Red Bulls being able to just kind of pick up where they left off and execute, and New York City FC really getting this kind of new look where maybe it wasn't necessary. But I think we've still found that, as we've said all season about them, like, when they're playing well, yeah, they look like the best team in MLS. But when they don't play well, they just look so stunningly below their levels that you see all the little cracks and all the things that you go, this is a team with a giant name, one of the world's best players on their team. But if that's not working out, then all of a sudden everything sort of begins to fall apart. And, I mean, you're falling apart to a very, very good squad, but I don't blame you for falling asleep in this one. I managed to watch it, but I was sort of watching it half paying attention because it just, it really was all Atlanta for 90 minutes and just never, never looked like New York City even had a chance.
No. We've wondered with David Villa's presence. They spend so much time kind of lumping it to him. A lot that you wonder if maybe that focus is somewhat of an issue. And the reports are coming out of Spain, according to the NYCFC Nation attributes to the Spanish newspaper Sport, that New York City indeed is not going to offer him a playing position next year. If he wants to take a front office position, it's his. According to these reports, but if he wants to play, and the newspapers say he does, that he's going to have to look elsewhere for that.
Which I think is a good move, which is no disrespect to the incredible career he's had and what he's done for the club. But as you said, he's become such a focal point for the team that sometimes it overshadows other problems and the fact that they don't have the depth and versatility that probably they should. And, you know, we've seen teams have success spending a lot of money on one player, but New York City has not been one of them. And we saw it with the Pirlo experiment. You can justify it while you're winning games and doing well, but when you keep crashing out at the same point, you do begin to have to look at other things and say, okay, well, it can get us into the playoffs, but if it can't get us through the playoffs, then we need to change the formula. And I think they need to go a little bit younger and they need to get some more depth in their squad as well.
I don't want to, you know, say negative things about Dominic Torrent too early in terms of like, he still hasn't had time to build a squad of his own, you know? But you're right, they don't have the Toronto excuse anymore. As it was Toronto that created so many of their problems in past playoff years. But the common thread between, you know, Toronto and Atlanta is that too often it is New York City that is solved, you know? Like, there doesn't seem to be a lot of attempts to sort of adjust to take advantages of the weaknesses of an exploitable opponent. It's that coming up against a stronger force than themselves, they just tried to do their thing to the best of their abilities and get overran.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what happened. And it wasn't even that they necessarily played poorly. It was just they were outplayed and at every point and didn't seem to have a backup plan. And we've seen that with teams in MLS where they come in with one particular way of executing a thing. But when it doesn't work out, all of a sudden they're not quite sure what to do with themselves. And, you know, Sporting Kansas City has been one of those as well. However, defensively, they're usually good enough that they can kind of hang on.
Yeah. I have been, you know, vocal, you know, wondering about whether or not taking the break, the buyout of the knockout rounds is great for the top seeds. This has been a year in which, three of the four, I guess, top seeds, found their way to the finals as, the number one ranked team in MLS, New York Red Bulls were able to, I believe, record a rare feat by losing the first leg and then winning the tie, but not in penalties. Which I think was the unprecedented point with their win over Columbus. Columbus had ridden a hot hand on the way there, but they lost comprehensively 3-0 to the Red Bulls and 3-1 on aggregate. What was your take on this game?
I thought that Columbus put up a good fight. The fact that Red Bulls were able to score relatively early on. Alex Mühl sinks it, I think, in like around the 15th minute or so. It just took some of the momentum out of Columbus, and that the stadium got very loud and everything seemed to kind of shift in the Red Bulls' favor. But credit to Columbus for hanging on. Again, it just didn't quite feel like the game plan was fully there, and they started to get a little bit sucked into the dump and run game for much of the first half, rather than really trying to string some passes together. The second half, I thought, started much more brightly with Columbus beginning to control some more possession, but Daniel Royar just completely undoes them in 3 minutes, scores one goal and then scores another. And really, at that point, you sort of had to see the writing on the wall that Columbus was not going to find their way back into this one. And a noble effort, but with very few chances created. And I was a little bit surprised tactically that they played the way they did in the first half. Were you surprised by this result?
Well, the thing I wanted to say about those first two goals, the Mühl one was the hockey, as I would call it, the hockey goal, where Mühl gets his foot onto it. And then the Royar goal, this is where I'm not that surprised about the result. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, and I think Red Bulls remain the favorite because of this amazing build-up play through the area. We've seen throughout the season and even in the course of the playoffs, bad defending. We've seen, you know, poor marking. We've seen, like, all kinds of stuff. But this middle one was just sort of a series of great passes in the final third that eventually found Daniel Royar open. Whereas, like, Royar was great. Royer's finish was great. His positioning was great. His running to get into that position, that thing was great. And, of course, his follow-up goal right afterwards was great as well. But you look at a team that built the play through Tyler Adams the way that it did, and you think, oh, I don't... They were playing rings around the they're passing rings around the defenders, and I don't know how anyone could have stopped that.
No, and coupled with what is, I don't even think arguably at this point, but just the best defensive center back pairing in MLS.
Yeah,
between Parker and why is the name eluding me? I can
it's
see
not
his
long,
face.
Is it?
Yeah, Long. Thank you, and he just won Defender of the Year as well, Aaron
yes.
Long. They didn't even really have all that much to do on the night, but when they did, they were just able to shut it down. And the other thing, too, is you just see how many times Aaron Long is bombing forward and can get that forward because the other three defenders kind of tighten up and collapse a little bit and hold that back line, and teams just really don't seem to know what to do with it. So Red Bulls, for me, despite, I think, having... you know, a difficult task on their hands with Columbus, just really look like the strongest team heading into the conference finals.
Absolutely. They seem less exploitable than Atlanta do. They have shown more of an ability to adapt than Atlanta do. They have the final seed on. They have the seeding on Atlanta, so they will not play the second game of the tie at Mercedes-Benz Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
Predictions are made to be made fools of, but I gotta think that New York is in a really, really strong position. If I guess when you're first, any team other than the second ranked team would have also been a great pull as well. But you have to think that this is a situation they will feel confident in.
Absolutely. And considering how much we've talked about Red Bulls in the past as being a team that's built around BWP, who can just somehow, you know, score a late goal and win his team the game, there's another case, another result. 3 goals, a shutout. BWP had a couple of chances, couple of looks, but otherwise wasn't needed. And that's purposeful as well, and I don't think he would complain. I think he said as much that, like, now that everything's not on his back to win every single game or to score their only goals, things have opened up for them. And that puts them in an incredibly advantageous position. Of course, you have to think Atlanta can score goals against them. But considering how dangerous Red Bulls can look and the fact that they play a very similar possession-based game and press very similar to Atlanta, I'm really hoping that that tie is an exciting one, because I'm expecting that to deliver, if nothing else, just in terms of entertainment value, two teams that should be going at each other and trying to figure each other out.
Well, you know, when you look at Robles, he was very strong in terms of, you know, you got to think, when you say you think that Atlanta's got to be able to score goals. I think that this center-back partnership that you talk about has created sort of a complete package that is not what we ordinarily associate with the Red Bulls. Mm-hmm. I don't think, and this leads to sort of our, continuing our conversation from last week about, like, how have we not had as many conversations about them being so dominant? They haven't fit the profile of a very, you know, a dominating attacking team in MLS.
Mm-hmm.
But also that's partially because they've been a much scrappier team, a team that defends much better, a team with 11 fewer goals conceded in the regular season than Atlanta, and 7 fewer goals conceded than Sporting Kansas City, which is usually the watermark for these kinds of things.
Yeah, and it says a lot about an MLS team that can concede so few goals and fly under the radar for it so much, right? MLS is around goal-scoring talent, high-speed, high-entertainment games. So games that are 1-1 nothing or 2-1 don't always make the highlight reels as much, don't always get as much talk. But, you know, and credit to Red Bulls for flying under the radar somehow and getting here. And it's kind of funny now that you and I, but also, like, MLS is suddenly like, oh, yeah, Red Bulls, they're great. And it's like the whole season they've been like, yeah, we know. Did you see how many games we won and how few goals we conceded? And everybody's like, yeah. But, like, did you see Zlatan's kick?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know if they've changed it, but as recently as Thursday, when we were recording our last episode, I joked that if you wanted a pride of place on the MLS YouTube page, be the team that Zlatan scores a milestone goal against, and It's still the goal against the Whitecaps in the key position on MLSsoccer.com, or it was at that time. I'm checking now to see if they've changed it. They should have changed it, but they haven't made any more. Nope, it's still Zlatan. That's still the number one thing going on in MLS videos, because you're right. They haven't won in a sexy way.
Yeah.
But they're in a key position. So from these four teams, you said that, do you what? From these four teams, you said, you know, it's hard to predict who's going to be in the finals. I'm kind of like, you know, leaning on the Red Bull side, but I feel a little more mutable in terms of SKC Portland. Mm-hmm. My original bracket that I did up had Kansas City and New York in the final.
Mm.
So if I get those right, I'll earn enough points to make up for the fact that Philadelphia definitely didn't make it out of the first round.
Portland
does look great after that win, don't they?
They do, but again, I mean, they didn't make it easy for themselves, and so it really just. But again, you could say the same thing about Sporting Kansas City. So for me, it really is like you've got to have the whiteboard and the markers out, and you're just going around in circles. You're like, well, if Atlanta does this and this happens and this is right, the New York Red Bulls might lose. But if this happens and this happens, especially over two legs, my gut feels like it's Portland and New York Red Bulls in the final. And I will not be at all surprised if it's Sporting Kansas City and Atlanta United in the final. Like, I just, at this point, I'm like, what's the point in guessing? Everything, you know, the wheels are off the bus. It's hard to tell, but God, there's a lot of momentum behind New York Red Bulls. And if they can keep it together and get hold of this sort of winning mentality that folks have been talking about being missing, I mean, they really do look like the team to beat. And especially for the conference finals, over two legs, I think they probably have the right stuff. It's a question of when they do go to Atlanta for that first leg, can they limit the damage?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And if they are able to do it, that's going to speak volumes, you know, in the way that New York City being unable to get anything at home was its own kind of death knell.
Yeah.
Like, if Atlanta can't get anything at home, and it's so strange to even contemplate that possibility.
I would say if Red Bulls can hold them to one, if they can hold them to one,
yeah,
like they did with Columbus, I think they'll do okay. Right? If they come into their 1-0, I mean, certainly if they come into their 1-1, they can go win at home. That's there for them. If Atlanta has a game like they can do where they open New York up and they can score, like let's say it's 3-1, I think it's going to be real difficult, and Atlanta's going to bring everything to that final game and leave it out there. But Atlanta's that wild card, right? Like they, mm-hmm. If we're talking about teams with multiple gears, Atlanta's one of them, right? They always do have a sub sort of other game plan they can turn to.
Now, the one thing that you look at that is a, you know, a big sort of question mark in that is that Atlanta is winless against the Red Bulls in all competitions. In MLS.
That doesn't bode well.
They are 0-3-1 in four regular season opportunities. I don't have any Open Cup stuff in front of me, so I don't know if they've met at any other occasion.
And Atlanta will also be without Nagby, who I feel like has not been always great for them this year, but certainly I sort of tweeted out during the game, like, how do we evaluate Nagby's season for them? And then he had a hell of a game and was all over the place and played his heart out, but he is out with injury, so he's going to miss at least the first game.
He's had such a weird season because his you know, I've just so been not aware. Like, I think that as much as it's fine to say, oh, he's worked hard, he's you know, generated good things for them. Like, what made him a star was his ability to generate goals as well for Portland. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, maybe he's modulated his game, but you've got to kind of look. You've got to kind of say that he's had a somewhat of an invisible season as a transferee.
Yeah.
Now I'm looking at So I'm trying to see. I was trying to look up what the. I was trying to look up what the away games results were in this year, see if I could remember them, to see if I could come up with a Let's do this. If you are okay, so we don't know which team. We don't know which team is gonna make it to the final, is going to win. But I think that we know how each team wins. So here would be one thing. Let me put you on the spot this way. Don't predict a team to win. Predict a finals MVP.
Sebastian Blanco.
Ooh. That is a tasty concept.
Or Shalloway. I can't pick one. I don't know who's going to win. I don't know what's going
to
happen.
Defend Blanco. You were about to do it.
I think Blanco has a quality, an ability to change games. Multiple people changed the game during that game this week. But, I mean, his read of the situation, his ability to step up and take a shot when there's really not a shot on. I think that there's just an extra bit of quality there and an understanding of the game that changes games. You don't always see it. I think it's why you often see him getting subbed on and not necessarily starting. But he is, I think that sometimes belies just how much talent he has and what an incredible impact he has been to the team. I think Portland has any number of players that can do that. And it's easy to sing the praises of Valeri or Armenteros, but I feel like Blanco's also got something to prove, that he hasn't always quite delivered on the promise that was to come with him, and I feel like there's more spoilers up his sleeve. I feel like he could cause some real problems.
I am going to I'm not going to steal your Shalloway.
Come Shalloway, come Shalloway with me. That's what I think every time I hear that name.
I'm going to say Melia. Because if Sporting Kansas City have a chance of winning that thing, this thing, it's going to take a number of key saves against some of the best strikers in the league. I imagine this scenario in a Sporting Kansas City Atlanta final the most, where they keep coming and they can't get anything by him or get very few amount of things by him to the point where there is, you know, there's no way you could look at a game like that and be like, if Melia is not in it, they're not winning.
Yeah, no, it's a good choice. And I like that it's a goalkeeper as well.
Now that we've fantasy booked to the final. The only other things I think that were going on, FC Cincinnati got a new crest. Some people are unhappy with it. I didn't get it at first, but there was a an individual on Twitter who had a good kind of revamp of it. That, like, I guess I kind of got it. Mike Pendleton, who is the same genius behind the Big Street videos, tightened the design up a little bit, and I kind of understand now why people thought it was bad, but. Hot take, the old Cincinnati crest was also bad.
I mean, yeah, neither one's particularly good. It looks sort of like a gas station logo.
Okay, that's true. Or like Pennzoil. It's like you would see it on the side of a racing car.
Yeah, get your oil change here, kids. It just sort of looks like someone ran over it. Like, it's just a little bit too stretched out. Like, they were trying to do something different with it, but it just, call me old-fashioned, it's not the shape of a soccer crest and looks too big for a badge. But, yeah, it's funny to me that you would take an already not great crest and just make it a little bit worse, rather than being like, well, if you're going to do it, go all the way and just completely revamp the entire thing.
What's the identity of Cincinnati? Like, because a lot of people are like, lions with pointy things.
I'm not sure they know, and I think that's how they ended up with this logo. As a team, they have a hell of an identity. We know how much branding can be important in today's game, and boy, did they miss an opportunity here.
Well, we're going to have a little bit of an opportunity next week to expand and reflect on the season and to look back at the Whitecaps fracas. In the meantime, where can we find you online?
You can find me online despondently tweeting about the underdogs at That's So MLS. Also on the Instagram, also at That's So MLS. Where can we find you?
You can find me online on Twitter at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com. You can find me at What a Howler. I am an editor at Howler Magazine, whatahowler.com. And you can find this podcast at thatsomls.com, on Apple Podcasts, and wherever great podcasts are found. Please rate, review, and subscribe.
Yeah, please do those things. And until next time, read the rules! Read the rules before you celebrate the win.